re-elected an average of 96% of the time, compared with Senate members who have been re-elected only 85% of the time, according to Rhodes Cook, an expert on election statistics. It is now statistically easier for a House member to be re-elected three times in succession than it is for a senator to be re-elected once. As a result, the founders' intention that House members would be on a shorter leash and more responsive to the public than the Senate has been stood on its head. Of course, the more fundamental change in the nature of the Senate came with the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, ratified in 1913, which provided for the direct election of senators. And indeed, in keeping with this new electoral reality, anecdotal evidence suggests that the Senate is actually now more skittish than the House of Representatives. Moreover, in contrast with the courageous 93rd Congress that helped to save our country from Richard Nixon's sinister abuses, the last Congress, controlled by the President's party, virtually abdicated its constitutional role to serve as an independent and co-equal branch of government. Instead, this Republican-led Congress was content, for the most part, to take orders from the President on what to vote for and against. Fortunately for our country, President Nixon was forced to resign before he could implement his outlandish interpretation of the Constitution, but not before his defiance of the Congress and the courts created a serious constitutional crisis. The two top Justice Department officials under President Nixon, Elliot Richardson and William Ruckelshaus, turned out to be men of great integrity. And even though they were loyal Republican partisans, they were more loyal to the Constitution, and they resigned on principle rather than implement what they saw as abuses of power by Nixon. Then Congress, also on a bipartisan basis, bravely resisted Nixon's abuses of power and launched impeachment proceedings. Some of our Congress's proudest hours in recent decades came in that trial, in that struggle. The decline and lack of independence shown by the last Congress would shock our founders more than anything else, because they believed that the power of the Congress was the single most important check and balance against the unhealthy exercise of too much power by the executive branch. As James Madison envisioned, ours is a deliberative democracy. Indeed, its deliberative nature is fundamental to the integrity of our social compact, because the essential alchemy of democracy, whereby just power is derived from the consent of the governed, can occur only in a process that is genuinely deliberative. Moreover, it is the unique role of the United States Senate, much more than the House of Representatives, to provide a forum for deliberation and to give adequate and full consideration to the strongly held views of the minority. And it is no accident that our founders gave the Senate the power to pass judgment on the fitness of nominees to the judicial branch, because they knew that respect for the law also depends upon the perceived independence and integrity of our judges. They wanted those qualities to be reviewed by the more reflective of our two bodies of Congress. As discussed in Chapter 2, the Republican assault on the judiciary included a threat by the Republican majority in the Senate to permanently change the rules of the Senate to eliminate the right of the minority to engage in extended debate of the president's judicial nominees. I was genuinely dismayed and deeply concerned by the actions and statements of some Republican leaders to undermine the rule of law by demanding that the Senate be stripped of its right to unlimited debate where the confirmation of judges is concerned. Our founders gave no role to the House of Representatives in confirming federal judges. If they had believed that only a simple majority was needed to safeguard the nation against unwise choices for the judiciary by a partisan president, they might well have given the House as well as the Senate the power to vote on judges. But they gave the power instead only to the Senate, a body of equals, each of whom was given a term of office three times longer than that of a representative, precisely to encourage a reflective frame of mind, a distance from the passions of the voters, and a capacity for deliberative consideration. They knew that the judges sent to the Senate would, if confirmed, serve for life, and that therefore their confirmation should follow a period of advice and consent in which the Senate served as an equal partner with the executive. The Senate's tradition of unlimited debate has been a controversial weapon in America's arsenal of democracy. For decades, it was used to frustrate the efforts of the majority to pass civil rights laws and has often been used for petty purposes by individual senators. Nevertheless, it has also frequently served to push the Senate and the nation as a whole toward a compromise between conflicting points of view, to breathe life into the ancient advice of the prophet Isaiah to come, let us reason together. In fact, under the procedures used by Republicans during the Clinton-Gore administration, far fewer than the 41 senators necessary to sustain a filibuster were able to routinely block the Senate from voting on judges nominated by the president by insisting on conducting a filibuster for even the least controversial among the nominees. A filibuster, of course, is a device used in the United States Senate to prevent the Senate from closing debate on a pending question and moving to an actual vote. 60 senators out of the 100 must vote in favor of shutting down the debate in order to allow a vote to take place. Therefore, a bare minimum of 41 senators can obstruct the ability of the majority to proceed to take a vote. During the period when the Republicans controlled the Senate, the majority leader routinely refused to bring nominations to the floor if a much smaller number of senators objected. To put the matter in perspective, when President Clinton and I left office, there were more than 100 vacant judge seats, owing largely to the passionate obstruction of the confirmation process by partisan Republicans. Ironically, near the end of the Clinton-Gore administration, Orrin Hatch, the Republican chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said, "There is no vacancy crisis," and a little perspective clearly belies the assertion that 103 vacancies represent a systematic crisis. Comically, soon after President Bush took office, when a number of vacancies had already been meaningfully reduced, Hatch sounded a shrill alarm. "The filibusters used to block such votes have mired the judicial confirmation process in a political and constitutional crisis that undermines democracy, the judiciary, the Senate, and the Constitution." I listened with real curiosity to some of the statements made during the recent debate about Republican efforts to do away with the filibuster debate. For example, I heard the former Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, who's from my home state and didn't know better, say, "Every judicial nominee who cleared the Senate's committee process received the courtesy of an up or down vote. Sometimes nominees were rejected on the floor, but they always received a vote." But I vividly remember. I witnessed the dozens of nominees sent to the Senate by President Clinton who were denied a vote and filibustered by various means. And I also remember in 1968, when my father was the principal sponsor of another Tennessean, Abe Fortas, who was nominated to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court by President Lyndon Johnson. Fortas was filibustered and denied an up or down vote. The closure vote took place on October 1, 1968. It failed 45-43. President Johnson was forced by the filibusters to withdraw the nomination. Never before in history? Saying that doesn't make it so. My father's Senate colleague and friend from Tennessee, Howard Baker, said during that filibuster, "On any issue, the majority of any given moment is not always right." That is precisely why our founders established a system of checks and balances, to prevent the accretion of power in any one set of hands, in either an individual or a group, because they were wary of what Madison famously called the mischief of factions. Yet a group of radical Republicans threatened a fundamental break with a system that has served us well for 230 years and served as a model for the rest of the world. In the words of columnist George Will, "The filibuster is an important dissent of minority rights, enabling a democratic government to measure and respect not merely numbers, but also intensity in public controversy. Filibusters enable intense minorities to slow down the governmental juggernaut. Conservatives who do not think government is sufficiently inhibited should cherish this blocking mechanism." Senator John McCain echoed George Will's sentiments, reminding his conservative colleague that they won't always be in the majority. And he added, "Do we want a bunch of liberal judges approved by the Senate of the United States with 51 votes if the Democrats are in the majority? The rules and traditions of the Senate all derive from the desire to ensure that the voice of the minority can be heard. The filibuster has been at the heart of this position for more than two centuries, and yet never before has anyone felt compelled to eliminate it. Now that control of the Senate has changed hands, there may well be the traditional shift in positions on the filibuster by members of both parties, but I am convinced that our nation has a greater need to reestablish the effectiveness of checks and balances and to rehabilitate the deliberative nature of congressional proceedings, especially in the Senate, which is intended to be the more reflective legislative body. Ultimately, however, the efficacy of checks and balances and the continued viability of the United States Constitution itself will depend upon a much more rigorous involvement of the American people in breathing life back into our founders' design. To do so, the American people must have access to a free flow of information about the operations of the executive branch. The fact that our normal safeguards have thus far failed to contain this unprecedented expansion of executive power is deeply troubling. This failure is due in part to the fact that the executive branch has followed a determined strategy of obfuscating, delaying, withholding information, appearing to yield but then refusing to do so, and dissembling in order to frustrate the efforts of the legislative and judicial branches to restore our constitutional balance. After all, the other branches can't check an abuse of power if they don't know it is happening. This administration has not been content simply to reduce the Congress to subservience. By closely guarding information about their own behavior, they are dismantling a fundamental element of our system of checks and balances. A government for the people and by the people should be transparent to the people. Yet the Bush administration seems to prefer making policy in secret, based on information that is not available to the public and in a process that is insulated from any meaningful participation by Congress or the American people. When Congress's approval is required under our current Constitution, it is to be given without meaningful debate. As Bush said to one Republican senator in a meeting, "Look, I want your vote. I'm not going to debate it with you." When reason and logic are removed from the process of democracy, when there is no longer any purpose in debating or discussing the choices we have to make, then all the questions before us are reduced to a simple equation. Who can exercise the most raw power? The system of checks and balances that has protected the integrity of our American system for more than two centuries has been dangerously eroded in recent decades, and especially in the last 6 years. In order to reestablish the needed balance and to check the dangerous expansion of an all-powerful executive branch, we must first of all work to restore the checks and balances that our founders knew were essential to ensure that reason could play its proper role in American democracy. And we must then concentrate on re-empowering the people of the United States with the ability and the inclination to fully and vigorously participate in the national conversation of democracy. I am convinced this can be done, and that the American people can once again become a well-informed citizenry. In the following chapter, I outline how. Chapter 9, A Well-Connected Citizenry. As a young lawyer giving his first significant public speech at the age of 28, Abraham Lincoln warned that a persistent period of dysfunction and unresponsiveness by government could alienate the American people, and that the strongest bulwark of any government, and particularly of those constituted like ours, may effectively be broken down and destroyed. I mean, the attachment of the people. Many Americans now feel that our government is unresponsive, and that no one in a position of power listens to or cares what they think. They feel disconnected from democracy. They feel that one vote makes no difference, and that they, as individuals, now have no practical means of participating in America's self-government. And unfortunately, they are not entirely wrong. Voters are now often viewed mainly as targets for easy manipulation by those seeking their consent to exercise power. What passes for a national conversation today is usually a television monologue consisting of highly sophisticated propagandistic messages. Indeed, in the elections of November 2006, Candidates in both political parties whom I asked about their campaign budgets told me they spent more than two-thirds of them on 30-second television advertisements. By using focus groups and elaborate polling techniques, those who design these messages, the heirs to Edward Bernays, are able to derive the only information they're interested in receiving from citizens. Feedback useful in fine-tuning their efforts at manipulation. Over time, the lack of authenticity becomes painfully obvious and takes its toll in the form of cynicism and alienation. And the more Americans who disconnect from the democratic process, the less legitimate it becomes. Buying a TV, which gives you the ability to receive information, fails to establish any capacity for sending information in the opposite direction. And the odd one-way nature of the primary connection Americans now have to our national conversation has a profound impact on their basic attitude toward democracy itself. If you can receive, but not send, what does that do to your basic feelings about the nature of your connection to American self-government? Attachment theory is an interesting new branch of developmental psychology that sheds light on the importance of consistent, appropriate, and responsive two-way communication and why it is essential for feeling empowered. First developed by John Bowlby, a British psychiatrist, in 1958, attachment theory was further developed by his protege, Mary Ainsworth, and other experts studying the psychological development of infants. Although it applies to individuals, attachment theory is, in my view, a metaphor that illuminates the significance of authentic free-flowing communication in any relationship that requires trust. By using this new approach, psychologists were able to discover that every infant learns a crucial and existential lesson during the first year of life about his or her fundamental relationship to the rest of the world. An infant develops an attachment pathway based on different patterns of care, and according to this theory, learns to adopt one of three basic postures toward the universe. Number one, in the best case, the infant learns that he or she has the inherent ability to exert a powerful influence on the world and evoke consistent, appropriate responses by communicating signals of hunger or discomfort, happiness or distress. If the caregiver, more often than not the mother, responds to most signals from the infant consistently and appropriately, the infant begins to assume that he or she has inherent power to affect the world. Number two, if the primary caregiver responds inappropriately and/or inconsistently, the infant learns to assume that he or she is powerless to affect the larger world, and that his or her signals have no intrinsic significance where the universe is concerned. A child who receives really erratic and inconsistent responses from a primary caregiver, even if those responses are occasionally warm and sensitive, develops anxious-resistant attachment. This pathway creates children who feature anxiety, dependence, and easy victimization. They are easily manipulated and exploited later in life. Number three, in the worst case, infants who receive no emotional response from the person or persons responsible for them are at high risk of learning a deep existential rage that makes them prone to violence and antisocial behavior as they grow up. Chronic unresponsiveness leads to what is called anxious avoidance attachment, a life pattern that features unquenchable anger, frustration, and aggressive violent behavior. The feelings of powerlessness are an adaptive function. The child adopts behavior that sets himself or herself up for more of the same. He or she becomes antisocial and stops evoking a feeling of warmth in other people, thus reinforcing the notion of powerlessness. Children then stay on the same pathway. These courses are not set in stone, but the longer a child stays on one course, the harder it is to move on to another. By studying the behavior of adults in later life who had shared this experience of learning powerlessness during infancy, the psychologists who specialize in attachment theory have found that an assumption of powerlessness once lodged in the brains of infants turns out to be difficult though not impossible, to unlearn. Those who grow into adulthood carrying this existential assumption of powerlessness were found to be quick to assume in later life that impulsive and hostile reactions to unmet needs were the only sensible response. Indeed, longitudinal studies conducted by the University of Minnesota over more than 30 years have found that America's prison population is heavily overrepresented by people who fell into this category as infants. The key difference determining which lesson is learned and which posture is adopted rests with the pattern of communication between the infant and his or her primary caregiver or caregivers, not with the specific information conveyed by the caregiver. What matters is the openness, responsiveness, and reliability and two-way nature of the communication environment. I believe that the viability of democracy depends upon the openness, reliability, appropriateness, responsiveness, and two-way nature of the communication environment. After all, democracy depends upon the regular sending and receiving of signals, not only between the people and those who aspire to be their elected representatives, but also among the people themselves. It is the connection of each individual to the national conversation that is the key. I believe that the citizens of any democracy learn over time to adopt a basic posture toward the possibilities of self-government. If democracy seems to work, and if people receive a consistent, reliable, and meaningful response from others when they communicate their opinions and feelings about shared experiences, they begin to assume that self-expression in democracy matters. When they can communicate with others regularly in ways that produce meaningful changes, they learn that democracy matters. If they receive responses that seem to be substantive but actually are not, citizens begin to feel as if they were being manipulated. If the messages they receive from the media feed this growing cynicism, the decline of democracy can be accelerated. Moreover, if citizens of a country express their opinions and feelings over an extended period of time without evoking a meaningful response, then they naturally begin to feel angry. If the flow of communication provides little opportunity for citizens to express themselves meaningfully, they naturally begin to feel frustration and powerlessness. This has happened all too often to minority communities who suffer prejudice and are not given a fair hearing by the majority for complaints. My generation learned in our youth to expect that democracy would work. Our frustration with the ineptitude and moral insensitivity of our national leaders in the last several years is balanced by the knowledge we gained in an earlier time and is influenced by the basic posture we adopted during our first experiences as citizens. Although many in my generation became disillusioned with self-government, most of us still believe that democracy works or can work, and that communication and participation are the keys to making it work well. In the United States of America, the torch of democracy, to use John F. Kennedy's metaphor, is regularly passed from one generation to the next. But what happens if the torch is passed to a generation that has learned to adopt a different posture toward democracy, and to assume that their opinions are not likely to evoke an appropriate, much less consistent, response from the broader community? Many young Americans now seem to feel that the jury is out on whether American democracy actually works or not. In contemporary America, we have created a wealthy society with tens of millions of incredibly talented and resourceful individuals who play virtually no role whatsoever as citizens. Compare this with to when our country was founded, when only a handful of people had the modern equivalent of a college education, but when so many were vitally engaged in the historic task of bringing forth into the world an ingenious republic that embodied a new form of representative democracy. In the early days of America's democracy, education and literacy were the prerequisites for establishing a connection to the body politic. In a world where communication was dominated by the printed word, those who learned to read also learned to write. Gaining the ability to receive ideas was automatically accompanied by the ability to send ideas. Expressing your own thoughts in the same medium through which you took in the thoughts of others. The connection, once established, was two-way. As Thomas Jefferson wrote, "The art of printing secures us against the retrogradation of reason and information." In practice, the use of the printing press was mainly by the elites in America's early decades, and the scurrilous, vitriolic attacks of that age certainly rivaled the worst of any modern political attacks. Nevertheless, the easy accessibility to the printed word opened up avenues of participation in the dialogue of democracy for people like Thomas Paine, who had neither family wealth nor political influence, other than what he gained with the eloquence of his writing. The age of printed pamphlets and political essays has long since been replaced by television, a distracting and absorbing medium that seems determined to entertain and sell more than it informs and educates. If the information and opinions made available in the marketplace of ideas come only from those with enough money to pay a steep price of admission, then all of those citizens whose opinions cannot be expressed in a meaningful way are in danger of learning that they are powerless as citizens and have no influence over the course of events in our democracy, and that their only appropriate posture is detachment, frustration, or anger. Our political system today does not engage the best minds in our country to help us get the answers and deploy the resources we need to move into the future. Bringing these people in, with their networks of influence, their knowledge, and their resources, is the key to creating the capacity for shared intelligence that we need to solve the problems we face before it's too late. Our goal must be to find a new way of unleashing our collective intelligence in the same way that markets have unleashed our collective productivity. We, the people, must reclaim and revitalize the ability we once had to play an integral role in saving our Constitution. The traditional progressive solution to problems that involve a lack of participation by citizens in civic and democratic processes is to redouble their emphasis on education. And education is, in fact, an extremely valuable strategy for solving many of society's ills. In an age where information has more economic value than ever before, it is obvious that education should have a higher national priority. It is also clear that democracies are more likely to succeed when there is widespread access to high-quality education. Education alone, however, is necessary but insufficient. A well-educated citizenry is more likely to be a well-informed citizenry, but the two concepts are entirely different, one from the other. It is possible to be extremely well-educated and, at the same time, ill-informed or misinformed. In the 1930s and 1940s, many members of the Nazi Party in Germany were extremely well-educated, but their knowledge of literature, music, mathematics, and philosophy simply empowered them to be more effective Nazis. No matter how educated they were, no matter how well they had cultivated their intellect, they were still trapped in a web of totalitarian propaganda that mobilized them for evil purposes. The Enlightenment, for all its liberating qualities, especially its empowerment of individuals with the ability to use reason as a source of influence and power, has also had a dark side that thoughtful people worried about from its beginning. Abstract thought, when organized into clever, self-contained, logical formulations, can sometimes have its own quasi-hypnotic effect and so completely capture the human mind as to shut out the leavening influences of everyday experience. Time and again, passionate believers in tightly organized philosophies and ideologies have closed their minds to the cries of human suffering that they inflict on others who have not yet pledged their allegiance and surrendered their minds to the same ideology. The freedoms embodied in our First Amendment represented the hard-won wisdom of the 18th century, that individuals must be able to fully participate in challenging, questioning, and thereby breathing human values constantly into the prevailing ideologies of their time and sharing with others the wisdom of their own experience. As Jefferson wrote in a letter to Charles Yancey, "The functionaries of every government have propensities to command at will the liberty and property of their constituents. There is no safe deposit for these but with the people themselves, nor can they be safe with them without information. Where the press is free, and every man able to read, all is safe." In the age of our founders, this human impulse to demand the right of co-creating shared wisdom accounted for the ferocity with which the states demanded protection for free access to the printing press, freedom of assembly, freedom to petition the government, freedom of religion, and freedom of speech. General George Washington, in a speech to officers of the Army in 1783, said, "If men are to be precluded from offering their sentiments on a matter which may involve the most serious and alarming consequences that can invite the consideration of mankind, reason is of no use to us. The freedom of speech may be taken away, and dumb and silent we may be led like sheep to the slaughter." But the 20th century brought its own bitter lessons. The new and incredibly powerful electronic media that began to replace the printing press, first radio and film, and then television, were used to indoctrinate millions of Germans, Austrians, Italians, Russians, Japanese, Chinese, and others with elaborate, abstract ideologies that made many of them deaf, blind, and numb to the systematic leading of tens of millions of their fellow human beings to the slaughter. Nazism, fascism, and communism were belief systems adopted passionately by millions of well-educated men and women. Taken together, all of the totalitarian ideologies were self-contained and delivered through a one-way flow of propaganda that prevented the people who were enmeshed in the ideology from actively participating in challenging its lack of human values. Unfortunately, the legacy of the 20th century's ideologically driven bloodbaths has included a new cynicism about reason itself. Because reason was so easily used by propagandists to disguise their impulse to power by cloaking it in clever and seductive intellectual formulations. In an age of propaganda, education itself can become suspect. When ideology is so often woven into the facts that are delivered in fully formed and self-contained packages, people naturally begin to develop some cynicism about what they are being told. When people are subjected to ubiquitous and unrelenting mass advertising, reason and logic often begin to seem like they are no more than handmaidens for the sophisticated sales force. And now that these same techniques dominate the political messages sent by candidates to voters, the integrity of our democracy has been placed under the same cloud of suspicion. Many advocacy organizations, progressive as well as conservative, often give the impression that they already have exclusive possession of the truth and merely have to educate others about what they already know. Resentment toward this attitude is also one of the many reasons for a resurgence of the traditional anti-intellectual strain in America. When people don't have an opportunity to interact on equal terms and test the validity of what they're being taught in the light of their own experience and share with one another in a robust and dynamic dialogue that enriches what the experts are telling them with the wisdom of the groups as a whole, they naturally begin to resist the assumption that the experts know best. If well-educated citizens have no effective way to communicate their ideas to others, and no realistic prospect of catalyzing the formation of a critical mass of opinion supporting their ideas, then their education is for naught where the vitality of our democracy is concerned. The remedy for what ails our democracy is not simply better education, as important as that is, or civic education, as important as that can be, but the reestablishment of a genuine democratic discourse in which individuals can participate in a meaningful way. A conversation of democracy in which meritorious ideas and opinions from individuals do, in fact, evoke a meaningful response. And in today's world, that means recognizing that it's impossible to have a well-informed citizenry without having a well-connected citizenry. While education remains important, it is now connection that is the key. A well-connected citizenry is made up of men and women who discuss and debate ideas and issues among themselves and who constantly test the validity of the information and impressions they receive from one another, as well as the ones they receive from their government. No citizenry can be well informed without a constant flow of honest information about contemporary events and without a full opportunity to participate in a discussion of the choices that the society must make. Moreover, if citizens feel deprived of a meaningful opportunity to participate in the national conversation, they can scarcely be blamed for developing a lack of interest in the process. And sure enough, numerous surveys and studies have documented the erosion of public knowledge of basic facts about our democracy. For example, From the data compiled by the National Election Studies on one recent election, only 15% of respondents could recall the name of even one of the candidates in the election in their district. Less than 4% could name two candidates. When there are so few competitive races, it's hard to blame them. Two professors, James Snyder and David Stromberg, found that knowledge of candidates increased in media markets where the local newspaper covered the congressional representative more. Very few respondents claimed to learn anything at all about their congressional elections from television news. Similarly, according to a survey conducted by FindLaw.com, only 43% of Americans could name a single Supreme Court justice. In the survey, respondents incorrectly identified George W. Bush and Arnold Schwarzenegger as Supreme Court justices. Moreover, the survey, released in January 2006, was conducted immediately after two new vacancies appeared on the courts. According to the 2000 National Election Studies Survey, only 11% could identify Supreme Court Chief Justice as the post held by William Rehnquist. The alienation of Americans from the democratic process has also eroded knowledge of the most basic facts about our constitutional architecture of checks and balances. When the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania conducted a broad survey on our Constitution, released in September 2006, they found that more than a third of the respondents believed the executive branch has the final say on all issues and can overrule the legislative and judicial branches. Barely half, 53%, believed that the president was required to follow a Supreme Court decision with which he disagreed. Similarly, only 55% of those questioned believed that the Supreme Court had the power to declare an act of Congress unconstitutional. Another study found that the majority of respondents did not know that Congress, rather than the president, has the power to declare war. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute conducted a study in 2005 of what our nation's college students knew about the Constitution, American government, and American history that provoked the American Political Science Association Task Force on Civic Education to pronounce that it is axiomatic that current levels of political knowledge, political engagement, and political enthusiasm are so low as to threaten the vitality and stability of democratic politics in the United States. The study found that less than half of college students recognized that the line, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," is from the Declaration of Independence. They also found that an overwhelming majority, 72.8%, could not correctly identify the source of the idea of a wall of separation between church and state. When the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation conducted a survey of high school students to determine their feelings toward the First Amendment, they found that after the text of the First Amendment was read to students, more than a third of them, 35%, thought that the First Amendment goes too far in the rights it guarantees. Nearly a quarter, 21%, did not know enough about the First Amendment to even give an opinion. Of those who did express an opinion, an even higher percentage, 44%, agreed that the First Amendment goes too far in the rights it guarantees. The survey revealed that nearly three-fourths of high school students either don't know how they feel about the First Amendment, or they take it for granted. Thomas Jefferson once wrote that, "Whenever the people are well informed, they can be trusted with their own government. That whenever things get so far wrong as to attract their notice, they may be relied on to set them right." He also said, "If a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be." But we are right now in a period of great vulnerability. As noted earlier, when television became the primary source of information in the United States, the marketplace of ideas changed radically. Most communication was only in one direction, with a sharp decline in participatory democracy. During this period of vulnerability for American democracy, while traditional television is still the dominant source of information, and before the internet is sufficiently developed and secured as an independent, neutral medium, there are other steps that can and should be taken to foster more connectivity in our self-government. For example, the Congress, both House and Senate, has failed to make the best use of television, radio, and the internet to connect with the citizens of each state and congressional district. The executive branch long ago adapted skillfully to television in order to maximize the impact of the president in communicating with the American people and with other audiences over electronic media. The Congress, by contrast, has seen individual members of the House and Senate maximize the use of electronic media, but the institution as a whole has not. The incumbent re-election rate has soared, but the respect for the legislative branch has plummeted. I was involved in the effort to open congressional sessions to live radio and television coverage in the late 1970s, and later, when I moved to the Senate, was involved in opening the Senate sessions to broadcasting coverage as well. But both the House and Senate have insisted upon requirements that the camera focus only on the individual members speaking. That was a necessary limitation to convince the congressional leadership to allow coverage at all. But as a result of that decision, there is no penalty for leaving one seat empty, and no penalty for the institution as a whole when virtually all of the seats are empty. It is one of the reasons why debates on the floor of the Congress are almost always poorly attended and almost never compelling anymore. Until recently, the scheduling of important debates in Congress was driven mainly by the convenience of the individual members, who routinely worked only 3 to 4 days a week in Washington and traveled back to their districts and states for nearly constant campaigning and to locations around the country for fundraising. The new leadership is experimenting with needed changes, but a priority should be placed on reconnecting the American people to the substance of the deliberative process. The most important and compelling debates should be scheduled for prime time. There's no doubt in my mind that many more Americans would pay careful attention to the arguments made during congressional debates if the House and Senate established a pattern of using the most convenient hours during weekday evenings for the most interesting debates. Another urgent task during this window of vulnerability is to try new approaches to limit the influence of large financial contributions to candidates for elected office. I am skeptical that any reform measures will be very effective so long as the principal means of communicating with voters is through expensive 30-second television advertisements. However, I have long supported full and robust public financing of all federal elections, with provisions that encourage all candidates to accept the funding and, in return, to agree to a prohibition on private financing of campaigns. I realize that the possibility of such laws being enacted is not high, but it is worth advocating nonetheless because of the severe damage being done to our democracy by the dominance of wealthy contributors. Paid disinformation in support of candidates and ballot initiatives is polluting America's democratic discourse. So long as it is politically impossible to simply prohibit such funding, we should pursue the next best option, increasing the transparency of all contributions to make it clear where the funding is coming from. Another revision would require full transparency in the funding of nonprofit organizations. To take one example of why such measures are necessary, consider the recent experience of California, when advocates of renewable energy sources pursued a public interest initiative, Proposition 87. The largest oil companies provided virtually all of the financing for television advertisements opposing the initiative and outspent supporters by more than $30 million, according to conservative estimates. However, when the voters went to the polls, many may have had no idea that the oil industry was principally responsible for the massive television campaign that persuaded the majority to vote no to the proposition. Some Californians have now proposed a requirement to complete disclosure of who is financing television advertisements during such campaigns so that the public will know which industry, trade, or political grouping is for or against a specific ballot initiative. Had this been law in 2006, the oil industry ads against Proposition 87 would have been prominently tagged, "Principal funding against this initiative is from the oil industry." The same language would appear in voter pamphlets and on the ballot itself. Similar disclosure would be required for radio and print advertising. I am skeptical about the wisdom of ballot initiatives in general because of the potential for stripping the democratic process of its necessary deliberative elements. Nevertheless, this kind of transparency would disarm this particular assault on reason and restore the initiative system to a semblance of democracy. Ultimately, however, no reform measures will save American democracy until and unless we find a way to restore the central role of a well-informed citizenry. The revolutionary departure on which the idea of America was based was the audacious belief that, as Thomas Jefferson said, an informed citizenry is the only true repository of the public will. Our founders knew that people who are armed with knowledge and the ability to communicate it can govern themselves and responsibly exercise the ultimate authority in self-government. They knew that democracy requires the open flow of information both to, and more important, from the citizenry. That means it is past time for us to examine our role as citizens in allowing and not preventing the dangerous imbalance that has emerged with the efforts by the executive branch to dominate our constitutional system and reverse the shocking decay and degradation of our democracy. Fortunately, we now have the means available to us by which the people of America can reestablish a robust connection to a vibrant and open exchange of ideas with one another about all of the issues most relevant to the course of our democracy. The Internet has the potential to revitalize the role played by the people in our constitutional framework. Just as the printing press led to the appearance of a new set of possibilities for democracy beginning 500 years ago, and just as the emergence of electronic broadcasting reshaped those possibilities beginning in the first quarter of the 20th century, the Internet is presenting us with new possibilities to reestablish a healthy functioning self-government even before it rivals television for an audience. In fact, the Internet is perhaps the greatest source of hope for reestablishing an open communications environment in which the conversation of democracy can flourish. It has extremely low entry barriers for individuals. The ideas that individuals contribute are dealt with in the main according to the rules of a meritocracy of ideas. It is the most interactive medium in history and the one with the greatest potential for connecting individuals to one another and to a universe of knowledge. An important distinction to make is that the Internet is not just another platform for disseminating the truth. It's a platform for pursuing the truth. And the decentralized creation and distribution of ideas, in the same way that markets are a decentralized mechanism for the creation and distribution of goods and services. It's a platform, in other words, for reason. But just as it is important to avoid romanticizing the printing press and the information ecosystem it created, it is also necessary to keep a clear-eyed view of the Internet's problems and abuses. It is hard to imagine any human evil that is not somehow abundantly displayed somewhere on the Internet. Parents of young children are often horrified to learn what obscene, grotesque, and savage material is all too easily available to children whose web surfing habits are not supervised or electronically limited. Teen suicides, bullying, depravity, and criminal behavior of all descriptions are described and, some would argue, promoted on the Internet. As with any tool put at the disposal of humankind, it can be and is used for evil as well as good purposes. And as always, it is up to us, particularly those of us who live in a democracy, to make intelligent choices about how and for what we use this incredibly powerful tool. But the Internet must be developed and protected in the same way we develop and protect markets, through the establishment of fair rules of engagement and the exercise of the rule of law. The same ferocity that our founders devoted to protect the freedom and independence of the press is now appropriate for our defense of the freedom of the Internet. The stakes are the same, the survival of our republic. The rapid growth and the importance of the Internet in consumer markets for goods and services and the rapid adoption of Internet advertising strategies by business clearly imply that it may be only a matter of time before the Internet plays a much larger role in fostering the conversation of democracy. The challenge is to accelerate that process and shape its evolution in ways that are conducive to the reemergence of a fully functional democracy, because this outcome is far from inevitable. We must ensure that the Internet remains open and accessible to all citizens without any limitation on the ability of individuals to choose the content they wish, regardless of the Internet service provider they use to connect to the World Wide Web. We cannot take this future for granted. We must be prepared to fight for it because of the threat of corporate consolidation and control over the Internet marketplace of ideas. Far too much is at stake to ever allow that to happen. We must ensure by all means possible that this medium of democracy's future develops in the mold of the open and free marketplace of ideas that our founders knew was essential to the health and survival of freedom. There are several technological and political obstacles that we, collectively as a nation, will have to determine how to overcome. As one of the founders of the Internet, Vinton G. Cerf, testified before Congress in early 2006, "The vibrant ecosystem of innovation that lies at the heart of the Internet creates wealth and opportunities for millions of Americans. That ecosystem, based upon a neutral, open network, should be nourished and promoted." In fact, it is precisely this goal that many hope the Internet can accomplish, to create a connected or wired democracy. And there have been some promising signs that the Internet will resuscitate and revitalize our democratic discourse. The easy accessibility individuals have to publish ideas on the Internet has led to the emergence of a new meritocracy of ideas that is similar in some ways to the public forum that existed during the time of America's founding. The Internet has several structural characteristics that make it particularly useful and powerful as a tool for reinvigorating representative democracy. One of the features of Internet communication that makes it so accessible to individuals is its heavy reliance on text. Anyone who learns to read text also learns to write text. For most people, publishing a text message on the Internet is even easier today than publishing a printed pamphlet was in the late 18th century. Moreover, in contrast to radio and television broadcasting, there is no inherent limitation on the number of entryways to the public forum as it exists on the Internet. It is also a nearly ideal medium for individuals with common perspectives and concerns to find one another and form communities around their shared interests. Already, online organizing has become a very powerful new feature of America's democracy. Online political communities like MoveOn.org and RightMarch.com are bringing more people into the political process by using the Internet to foster participation. They not only use the Internet as an online organizing tool, but also to organize meetings offline, like house parties. Their email lists are used to alert its members to new political and societal developments that may be of interest to them and about which they might not otherwise know anything. In my own experience, I have used AlGore.com to connect with hundreds of thousands of people to communicate about the climate crisis. MoveOn.org joined with AlGore.com to host 12,000 people last year when the DVD version of An Inconvenient Truth was released by Paramount. During the same period, by the way, RightMarch.com was among the many websites on the right of the spectrum that were attacking me for my views about climate change. The power of online organizing has also begun to create hope for many that America's current system of financing political campaigns, now dominated by special interests, might eventually be replaced by the millions of small donations collected online, outweighing the smaller number of larger contributions from big donors. The relatively recent development and growth of blogging is also a promising sign for our national conversation. Generally speaking, bloggers are concerned citizens who want to share their ideas and opinions with the rest of the public. Some have genuinely interesting things to say, while others do not, but what is most significant about blogging may be the process itself. By posting their ideas online, bloggers are reclaiming the tradition of our founders of making their reflections on the national state of affairs publicly available. And they do so in a new way. As Larry Lessig, law professor at Stanford Law School and founder of the Center for Internet and Society, wrote, "People post when they want to post, and people read when they want to read. Blogs allow for public discourse without the public ever needing to gather in a single public place. As a result, blogging is becoming a major institutional force capable of influencing national politics." In addition to text, individuals are now also expressing themselves on the Internet with video and flash animation. The rapid decline in the cost of digital video cameras and laptop video editing programs, and the simultaneous improvement in the quality of both, have now made it possible for millions of people to make short videos and share them with the world by means of the Internet. Video streaming is becoming more common over the Internet, and cheap storage of streamed video is making it possible for many television viewers to engage in what the industry calls time shifting to personalize their television watching habits. Moreover, as higher bandwidth connections continue to replace smaller information pipelines, the Internet's capacity for carrying television will continue to dramatically improve. The Internet does not yet approach the television medium as a dominant source for information, largely because its basic architecture and its reliance on many smaller as well as larger bandwidths prevents the mass distribution of full-motion video in real time. For the remainder of this decade, it is television delivered over cable and satellite that will almost certainly continue to be the dominant medium of communication in America's democracy. That is one of the reasons why I have worked over the last 6 years with my partner Joel Hyatt to innovate a new business model that empowers individuals to join the democratic discourse in the language and medium of television. Current TV relies on video streaming over the Internet as the means by which individuals send us what we call viewer-created content, or VC2. We rely on the Internet for the two-way conversation that we have every day with our viewers, enabling them to participate in the decisions on programming our network. We also offer free of charge at www.current.tv. what I believe to be the world's best online training program in how to make high-quality television content. I hope that increased and widespread familiarity with the mechanisms by which television is made can serve to demystify it, at least to some extent, and in the process weaken its quasi-hypnotic power. More important, I believe Current TV is demonstrating that democratizing television can facilitate widespread participation in our national discourse. We are trying to work within the medium of television to recreate a multi-way conversation that includes individuals and operates according to a meritocracy of ideas. There is a high degree of untapped creativity, intelligence, and talent, especially among young adults. We invite our viewers and the public at large to tell their stories on video and submit them to air on the network. Our goal is not political or ideological. The point is to foster a cornucopia of points of view and fresh perspectives that force people in rigid frameworks to reassess everything. Connecting individuals to the conversation of democracy over the medium that is by far the most important is a way of opening up this medium so individuals can get back into the conversation with whatever points of view they wish to bring to it. Another remarkable development that could strengthen our democracy is the unbelievably rapid explosion of wikis, most prominently Wikipedia. Wikis are websites that compile public information about particular areas of knowledge, or, in the case of Wikipedia, about almost everything. The idea behind wikis is that, in general, people as a group know more than any one individual. Anyone is allowed to contribute information to a wiki, though some subjects are patrolled and checked regularly to make sure that misinformation or disinformation does not distort the aggregation process. Wikis are sometimes abused. In fact, my friend and mentor in journalism years ago, John Siegenthaler, has been one of the most thoughtful critics of Wikipedia. But wikis are steadily improving in quality, reliability, and relevance. Another example of Internet applications that have enormous democratic potential is the emergent phenomenon of Web 2.0 social networks. While many think of websites such as Facebook.com and MySpace.com as opportunities for socializing and maintaining social networks, others have very effectively used these tools for overtly political purposes. And because they are completely decentralized, their potential for fostering participation is almost limitless. But for all the promise of the Internet, there is a serious threat to its potential for revitalizing democracy. The danger arises because there are, in most markets, a very small number of broadband network operators, and this may not change in the near future. These operators have the structural capacity to determine the way in which information is transmitted over the Internet and the speed with which it is delivered. And the present Internet network operators, principally large telephone and cable companies, have an economic incentive to extend their control over the physical infrastructure of the network to leverage control of internet content. If they went about it in the wrong way, these companies could institute changes that have the effect of limiting the free flow of information over the internet in a number of troubling ways. If that was the result, it would violate the Federal Communications Commission's long history of a policy of non-discrimination, which has guided the development of the internet since its inception. In the 1990s, Congress and the Clinton-Gore administration made the deliberate choice to impose very few regulations on the internet to encourage innovation, business, and political activity. Today, this long-established policy of non-discrimination has been redubbed net neutrality. In many ways, it is this principle that has been responsible for the trillions of dollars of economic growth spurred by the internet. The greatest success stories among internet businesses have been ideas pursued by small entrepreneurs who were not part of established businesses, including my friends Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who were graduate students in computer science at Stanford when they started Google. Moreover, just as home computers have become faster, more efficient, and much cheaper than they were a few years ago, so have virtually all of the components that make up the infrastructure of the internet, including high-speed switches and servers. These technological improvements have lowered the network operator's cost to transport each bit of information, the fundamental digital building block of all internet content. And because the cost of transporting bits has dropped, those providing internet content using bits can do much more at a lower cost, such as flash animation, live audio and video streams, and high-quality telephone calls. This sharp decline in the cost of transporting bits has also greatly increased the value the network represents to consumers, who naturally, as a result, have increased demand for internet access. But network operators such as AT&T and Verizon have not been able to capture as much of the increased value of the internet as they would like. Innovators at the edges of the network are bringing the new products to the internet, and the network operators have had difficulty increasing their rates for connecting to the internet because of competition from other access providers and consumer resistance to higher fees for access. As a result, the operators have a powerful incentive to look for new opportunities to capture what economists call rents on the increased value of the network. Because of the difficulty they encounter in charging consumers higher fees to connect to the network, these operators are proposing to impose brand new fees on web companies and others who put high volumes of content on the network and create two tiers of content providers. Those web companies that refuse to pay money to the network operators might find that their sites and applications stopped running quickly for internet users. As a result, these web companies would lose business and consumers